Oyez, oyez, oyez. All persons having business before the Honorable, the United States Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia Circuit are admonished to draw near and give their attention, for the court is now sitting. God save the United States and this Honorable Court. Be seated, please. Case number 05-5487 et al. Jamal Kiemba, next friend et al. Versus George W. Bush, President of the United States et al. Appellants. Mr. Loeb for the appellants, Mr. Moore for the appellees.
May it please the court, my name is Robert Loeb from the Department of Justice, and I represent the government in these appeals. The district court orders here restricting the United States from releasing Guantanamo detainees from U.S. custody to another country are in error and should be reversed.
Mr. Lowe, let me start off with a couple of questions that I have. According to Boumediene, isn't the habeas right that a detainee's won here the right to have their detention challenged before a district court?
They have that right to challenge their detention, but Munaf,
under Boumediene, they have that right. Now, if they're transferred, they lose that right.
If they can make a claim in the district court if there's ongoing effects. If someone who's in prison who is then released can say if there's ongoing effects of a prior conviction, can raise that claim in district court and make an argument in district court that the district court should continue.
If one of these detainees was transferred to another country and the detention continued in that other country,
right?
Are you saying they would have a right to bring?
No, Your Honor, let me be very clear about this. Munaf, that was exactly what was the case in Munaf. We were transferring the individuals to the Iraqi government, and these were citizens who had a habeas right, at least as great as the rights of the alien detainees in Boumediene. So we have citizens who have, the Supreme Court said, there's habeas jurisdiction. That was the holding of Munaf.
There's another factor in Munaf, right, is that Iraq's right as a sovereign to prosecute crimes. Right. That Munaf is primarily about that.
I disagree, Your Honor.
So does the success of your case rise and fall with whether it falls under Munaf?
We believe Munaf supports every element of our argument. It supports the element of our argument that it's not appropriate for the court just to issue a status quo order barring a transfer to another country. That's exactly what the district court and this court did in Munaf. The Supreme Court said that is not part of habeas authority.
What do you make of Justice Scalia's comment in his dissent where he was describing the Habeas Act of 1679? And according to Justice Scalia, I'm quoting now, it forbade the shipment of prisoners to places where the writ did not run or where its execution would be difficult. Is that an accurate description of the Habeas Act of 1679?
No, our reading of it is it prevented the sovereign from moving a detainee from one hand to another hand of the sovereign, but outside the jurisdiction of the courts. So, for example, it would prohibit us. It would prohibit us from.
I think that's the language of the act, but.
The act prohibits the sovereign from removing him from the jurisdiction of the courts. But it was talking about. It was referring to territories within the. Within the sovereign domain, which we're
no,
still...
No, the language I'm reading from Article 12 of the Act, and it says, which are at any time hereafter shall be within or without the dominions of His Majesty. I mean, the purpose of the Act was to stop the practice of moving prisoners from within a place where the writ ran to where it didn't run. And that's exactly what you're talking about.
I think relying on the dissent in Munaf is a mistake.
I'm not relying on the dissent. I'm relying on his description of the act.
I think the nature of the habeas right and whether the transfer to another country, which would remove the jurisdiction of the courts, what runs contrary to the writ and the power of the court, is answered by Munaf. In that case, they were challenging the lawfulness of detention. If you read the Supreme Court's opinion, it says they are challenging the lawfulness of the United States detention of them. It says there is habeas jurisdiction over these citizens, yet it said there is no authority of the courts to bar the United States from transferring.
But the court in Munaf relied on the assurances of the executive branch.
We have the same assurances.
Well, not really. The assurance in Munaf was in the individual case. Are you saying that you would be okay with a holding that required a showing in each individual case similar to the showing in Munaf?
Your Honor, I think the sworn declarations we have of our policy, which applies to every single case, is adequate. If it's necessary for us to file individualized declarations to have the deputy secretary file a declaration as to every case, I don't think that's a worthwhile endeavor. But we could do that.
Why is that not a worthwhile endeavor to ensure
that the court requires it, we would do that, Your Honor.
To ensure that the policy that's been outlined by the government is followed in each individual case, and that would bring it squarely within Munaf.
Well, if that's what's required, Your Honor, then that's what we'll do. But
Mr.
we
Love,
have
Mr. Love, wait a minute. The declaration of Waxman at 109 says, where continued detention is deemed no longer necessary, a detainee may be transferred to the control of another government for release. Furthermore, the U.S. also transfers Gitmo detainees under appropriate circumstances to the control of other governments for continued detention, investigation, and or prosecution when those governments are willing to accept responsibility for ensuring, consistent with their laws, that the detainees will not continue to pose a threat to the U.S. and its allies.
I mean, those declarations.
Does the phrase, under appropriate circumstances, for continued transfer for continued detention, investigation, and or prosecution, include any transfer for detention other than in connection with a charge such as in Munaf?
Your Honor, it would be entirely up to that sovereign government as to whether the basis for holding them. What the declarations go on to say, both
so
the Waxman.
So they might be held as a material witness or on some other ground.
That would be up to it would be under the laws of that foreign government. The Prosper and the Waxman declarations go on to explain that any decision to detain the detainee after they're sent to the other country is entirely up to that other country. And there are certainly circumstances where we have expectations that a person will be continued detained, and often we find that they're not detained shortly thereafter. It's entirely up to that. You know, that's why, as in Munaf, transfer of the person to the other country is an act of foreign affairs matters. We take the person, he's an alien, we move him to another country. What happens to him in that other country is entirely up to that country after the transfer occurs.
All right, now, all of this seems to go to the merits rather than the jurisdictional question.
This is
tied to the jurisdictional question.
I think we've moved more into the merits point, Your Honor, but it's also a question of what's justiciable in this instance, too. I think it's important to see what's going on here. What would a court examine if it was reviewing our decision to transfer someone to a particular country? As the Prosper and Waxman declarations explain, these transfers are often based on obtaining assurances that the person will be properly treated once we transfer to them to that country. The declarations go on to explain that those are highly sensitive types of negotiations which are done in private, and that if those type of negotiations...
There have been a number of detainees who've been transferred and have been given notice, right?
That is
quite a few, right? Have there been any problems?
Well, we have
those?
60 detainees who have been for a prolonged period of time, including the detainees here, who have been cleared for release and transferred.
No, I'm talking about, haven't there been instances where detainees have actually been transferred?
You gave them notice,
and they didn't object?
Our hands are being tied by these quarters, but we are still giving 100% effort to clear up people from Guantanamo whenever possible and to hold them the minimal amount of time possible. So we are doing what we can to move them.
But are there examples where detainees have been transferred to custody of other countries?
Absolutely.
And the detainee was given notice ahead of time?
Absolutely.
The court and counsel
required by these orders to give counsel.
And any instances there where you had problems with the negotiations?
There are some countries which won't deal with us under these circumstances of these, and there's others who won't engage in these assurance discussions. It makes it much more difficult, and especially when you're dealing with a sensitive group like the Uyghurs, where there's other difficulties in moving them. I think it's very notable that the Uyghurs we did move to Albania back in 2006. There were not orders requiring a notice to the court and counsel. And had there been, I can assure you the fact that transfer would have not occurred.
In the instances where transfers were made and notice was given to a court, are there examples there where that notice to the court posed a problem?
Sure,
to the proposed transfer?
We have the order just the other day we sent the court where we provide a notice and then they run to district court and the district court orders a status quo holding order barring the transfer. We have Belbacha where
are there problems in the negotiations? Is there a problem with the notice to the court has caused a problem in the negotiations with the country?
When those countries know that when we have to give notice that what would happen with Judge Hogan the other day and what happened in Balbacha can't occur, it not only scuttles that one transfer, but can also scuttle a whole group of transfers.
And that has actually happened, you're saying?
Yes, Your Honor.
You represented, I think, that the transfer in 06, you said, would not have happened?
Would have not have happened, Your Honor.
Had the notice been in effect?
Been in effect. And I think it's notable that all the Uyghurs who had no notice order requirement are all gone from Guantanamo, and those who still have notice requirements are still at Guantanamo. Is that the only problem in moving them? No. But does it tie our hands with a difficult situation? Yes. But also, what is a court going to do at the end of the day? A court should not exercise authority restricting our ability to transfer unless, at the end of the habeas case, it can micromanage where we're going to send them and review the assurances we get from the other country. Because if it doesn't have that authority, it has no business getting involved in an earlier stage.
Can I ask you a question about Boumediene, which held, of course, that the detainees have a constitutional right to habeas corpus? Do they also have a constitutional right to due process?
Our position is that they don't, Your Honor, but it's also clear from Munaf that it doesn't make a difference here.
What's the basis for saying, given the historical origins of the two rights and that they're intertwined, habeas corpus and due process, to say that the detainees have the constitutional right to one but not the other?
We have full briefing. This we made in the district court and also in the military commissions, and we could submit that to you.
But it's important to determine. In determining whether notice is appropriate, it's important to know whether there's an ultimate right at the end of the day. If there's no right at the end of the day, then notice doesn't serve a purpose. But if there is a right to object to a transfer, then notice will serve a purpose.
I think you can say even presuming due process rights, we had citizens with due process rights in Munaf. We had in Holmes versus Laird due process rights with the plaintiff in that case. And the court said that in habeas, there is no authority of a court to restrict the transfer to another foreign sovereign. So you don't need to decide here whether there are due process rights or not, because we know from Munaf, even where there are due process rights.
Filing a Munaf-style declaration in each individual case before the proposed transfer affect the negotiations?
But before the – now, Your Honor, I would say we would file in each case in opposition to this type of order. I mean, the orders themselves we think are improper, and in response to them.
Let me be clear. Filing a declaration in each case that the proposed transfer is done with the belief and assurances that it's not likely that the detainee will be tortured, would filing that in each case without anything more, would that affect negotiations?
Well, if it's subject to the prospect of the reason you're doing this would be perhaps because it's subject to the prospect of judicial review. And the Supreme Court did not say you needed to file those. It said very clearly.
It didn't say that, but it relied on that as the basis for not.
I think noting that the Solicitor General stated an oral argument that.
Well, it also distinguished the more extreme case where the executive wanted to transfer someone despite its belief that it was likely.
Right. I think they say that on the opposite end of the scale we have where the government is intentionally sending someone to another country to be tortured. There is no allegation to that here. There's no suggestion of it. And we have sworn declarations from high-level officials saying our policy before we send any of the individuals out of Guantanamo is to actually get assurances that they'll be properly treated and no one is sent out of Guantanamo otherwise. I think to require that we negotiate the case and then we submit declarations regarding our negotiations to court is just the type of interference that Munaf is saying that a court doesn't have the authority to do. But if we have to do that, we will, Your Honor. But if the court doesn't have authority to second-guess those declarations or examine the assurances, I'm not sure what the point is of those filings other than that we'd be making it in individualized cases. But again, if that's necessary, that's what we'll do. But we already have a system which is being severely taxed in the habeas litigation otherwise. But again, we'll do what we have to. We have a goal of getting people out of Guantanamo to the greatest degree possible, not to hold them there any longer than necessary.
Let's talk about jurisdiction at least a bit. All right, your brief. Let's see. This is your supplemental brief, August 21, at 15. pardon me, at the bottom paragraph. says that Boumediene discusses the detainee's constitutional right to bring only core habeas actions, right? As opposed to any other action, and that E2 in no way impairs their ability to pursue a writ of habeas corpus simply limits other types of actions.
That's
right. Now, there seems to be an undistributed middle here. There are, by your account, there are core habeas cases in E1 and non-habeas cases in E2. What happens to non-core habeas cases?
Well, our view, they would still fall within the strip of both E1 and E1, and that all the Supreme Court said was the suspension clause would be violated if you
non-core
deprive
habeas
that, and that's all
E1.
And that's all the,
here's what you
the constitutional habeas.
Here's what you wrote. The court's opinion discusses the detainee's constitutional right to bring only core habeas actions.
Right.
Right. So you're saying, well, they didn't discuss it, but it's still there? The non-core habeas cases are still there in E1?
Yes, Your Honor. For example, conditions of confinement. We've cited authority. We have Judge Hogan who cites that you can't bring conditions of confinement cases in habeas. But sometimes we have other district courts which have exercised habeas jurisdiction over conditions of confinement. So sometimes habeas has been used flexibly beyond its core purpose of examining lawfulness of detention.
Part of the historical core of habeas was transfer claims, right? Extradition. Hasn't extradition traditionally been reviewable in habeas?
By statute also permits that. But in extradition, a court does not review the type of claims here as assurances or the propriety of sending them to another country. And the Supreme Court in Munaf itself cited extradition.
The court reviews whether there's a basis for sending the person to another country.
Right. And here, there's no question of basis to sending them to another country.
In other words, the courts in extradition cases historically have not said, oh, habeas has no application to this.
That's right, Your Honor. But that's a question of they're being detained here while they're under an order to remove them to another country. So they're being taken into custody, subject to removal. And the question is there authority to do that? And here, what would they get to the end of the day if they win their habeas case? They would get the right to release from U.S. custody. And we are attempting to grant them right of release from U.S. custody and transferring them to another country. The question is, then what? Do they get, at the end of the day, to examine, have a court examine where they're sent and whether we have adequate assurances of how they're being treated? And we can see from Munaf and we can see from the extradition cases cited in Munaf that that's not the case. And if it's not true for the U.S. citizens in Munaf and not true for the U.S. citizens in the extradition cases cited by Munaf, certainly it's not true for aliens being held outside of the United States in Guantanamo.
Mr. Loeb, suppose that the alien's claim is that he's concerned about being transferred to a place where he will almost certainly die of a disease because they don't have the ability to treat his condition, which is being treated at Guantanamo, or because it's a high altitude and he won't survive in a high altitude. It's a medical claim. Would you say that there's no right to?
Again, I would say that's a question of how he's going to be treated and how we are taking care with the other country that he's appropriately going to be housed and treated in the other country as medical conditions may take care of. That's a question of sovereign to sovereign relations.
I'm not assuming that he's going to be detained in the.
No, even just that he'll be that there'll be the provisions in that country.
Where in the declarations is there any indication that you receive those kinds of assurances or solicit them?
I think it's just talking in general assurances that he'll be properly treated.
I didn't see that. Where's that?
I'll have to bring that up on if there's more general statements, but that's not certainly that's not the claims type of claims that we have here. And again, a court just as in Munaf and these other circumstances should not be in the business of managing where a person is sent when they're sending them to the custody of a foreign sovereign.
Well, the interference that you claim with negotiations vis-a-vis another country might be substantially less if it's predicated not on sensitive issues, but
on
the straightforward medical. I disagree.
If we say, look, this guy has a cancer and he needs a proper treatment, and we said to the country, we're sending him to your country, you'll make sure he gets proper treatment, and they say yes to us, and we investigate it. They give us their Secretary of State comes and gives us their assurance. And
anything in the record on this?
On that? Well, they don't raise that. There's never been a claim like that. So obviously, there's no record on that. on that sort of hypothetical because it hasn't been at issue in these cases.
Okay, but you're making a representation about the practice, but that's not this case and it's not in the record. So
and I assure you that we take care that when a detainee is sent that it's an appropriate circumstance. I think that if you read, certainly the atmospherics of these declarations is that's the type of concerns that we have, that they be properly treated when we send them to another country.
Are the Waxman and Prosper declarations still current? They're 3.5 years old.
Yeah, they are right. We have more recent declarations in the district court. We'll be happy to supply to you. We filed them in other when we move someone, and we have multiple filings here. When we move people to other countries to dismiss DTA cases and moot, we filed the more recent declarations by the current officials, which are to the same effect. I think the more declarations are a little clearer on the fact that when we send people, we don't keep custody of them, and it's entirely up to the other sovereign. I think some of the language you quoted from the Waxman Prosper was, there's language there which clearly says what I'm the point that I'm making, that we don't control them at all. But I think there's also the language you quoted which could be misread. The more recent declarations are clearer on that point. We've already filed those in this court multiple times. Happy to file the current declarations with you again. Again, we're in a record review here, so I was hesitant to do that.
The motion for the preliminary injunction in front of the district court, that was filed within the habeas action, right?
That's within the habeas. It
wasn't a separate action.
Habeas action, and we have district courts which never reached the likelihood of success, which Munaf says you have to do. We have courts basically preserving status quo, barring our hands, tying our hands. It's been 3 years now. We have orders, sort of temporary status quo orders, barring us, restricting us from transferring these individuals. Mm-hmm. So we think the court today, should reach these issues, reach the merits of these issues, reach the jurisdictional questions, because they pertain not just to this case, but to...
If it's within the habeas action and it's not a separate action, why it falls under E1 then, doesn't it? It's not E2. E2 speaks about other actions. Doesn't talk about other motions.
It's not part of habeas relief. So if the fact that you package it within a habeas action, the habeas actions also speak to all sorts of other, type of relief that they would like as well. The fact that you place it in a habeas petition doesn't mean that it's part of appropriate habeas relief. And the Supreme Court's moving on.
It's not another action, right?
There's one action here, but the fact that if they within the habeas action ask for damages doesn't mean that the damages are.
But the statute on its face makes a distinction between an application for a writ of habeas corpus, right? That's E1. And then E2 talks about other actions.
Right. Our argument, which was cited by Judge Ginsburg earlier, is that E1 is only struck down by the Supreme Court only to the extent it pertains to core habeas regarding challenges to actual detention, and to the extent someone's raising periphery claims, which are not core habeas claims, like transfer claims.
But you would acknowledge it doesn't fit within E2, right?
No, I think you can't escape E2 just by packaging something in a habeas petition, Your Honor. And that the intent of Congress. Look, they cite the cat. What is their likelihood of success? They cite the fair and the cat, which don't apply to this context. Congress in that context said you can only raise Convention Against Torture claims in the immigration context. The Real ID Act says that expressly. What we have here is a clear statement from Congress to the contrary. E2, they're saying, look, we're not only saying you, the courts, I think it was a question 2 years ago when we had an argument, could Congress come in and provide cat rights in these circumstances? And they could. Congress not only has not, but has expressly said to the contrary by E2, saying courts keep your hands off of transfer matters.
Say transfer matters. It says any other action relating to any aspect of the detention. That doesn't mean the word action is superfluous here.
If E1 is only struck down as it pertains to court habeas and these transfer matters are not core habeas, E1 bars jurisdiction. And our point regarding E2 is that, just because you call a damage action an APA action or something else and package it in habeas doesn't remove it from E2. It's not a question of clever pleading to avoid E2, that you package it within a habeas case. But the intent of Congress is clear. Congress could have provided cat rights. They did not. And they expressly said, we expect the courts not to exercise jurisdiction over transfer matters. And I think the courts continue to enter bars against transferring people from Guantanamo, it's an important national policy interest to remove all those from Guantanamo who can be removed. It's the policy of this president, it's policy, and the Secretary of State, the Department of Defense Secretary has said so. And these injunctions shouldn't be permitted to stand.
If we were to find jurisdiction, and the district court were to be engaging in a Rule 65 analysis, what's the What's the question that they ask? Likelihood of success on the merits of what? On the transfer or the ultimate issue?
I mean, that's the critical question, Your Honor, that likelihood of success is not likelihood of success on the habeas underlying core action of whether they're lawfully detained or not. Because it's because even if they're found not to be lawfully detained, they get a release order. Can a court then do what it's doing now, restrict our ability to release them? A court can't have more authority now in the beginning of the case or the middle of the case than it does at the end of the case. And Munoz says the court doesn't have authority to bar that transfer and therefore cut that case short, even though they were challenging the lawfulness of their detention in that very case. So, in their brief, they basically argue that they have a likelihood of success based on the FAR Act and the Convention Against Torture. But as we explain in our briefs, those
and the Due Process Clause.
And the Due Process Clause.
I'll come back to that. But you haven't really explained to me why the Due Process Clause doesn't apply to these detainees, other than to say we could assume that it does and it still wouldn't get them anywhere, I think.
I think if you want briefing on that, Your Honor, that's not something I could, you know, get up here and explain in 2 minutes. I'm happy that we could have for the briefing.
Isn't that a critical question?
I don't think it's critical, given Munoz, that they had full due process rights and said a court has no role regarding the transfer. But I think in brief, the argument is that the Supreme Court's Boumediene decision, focused on the detention of individuals being a core right and that the court can review that, but didn't say that they have any substantive rights beyond that, other than the court can just, under the great writ, examine the lawfulness of detention. And we have argued in the district court, and I don't think fully prepared to give the long version of that to the court. And if you don't think Munoz speaks and controls that issue where they had full due process rights, we're happy to submit further briefing. They haven't.
Well, I was just challenging your assertion that they have no due process rights, but we'll come back to that.
Mr. Lowe, before you sit down, somewhere in your brief, I guess it's in the supplemental response brief, you deal with the passage or the point being made, here it is at 12, point being made by the detainees that the Habeas Corpus Act of 1679, where we started this discussion, where Judge Griffith has started us, you acknowledge it restricted the king's practice of sending prisoners to places he controlled, but beyond the reach of the courts. There was no law, you say, restricting the release of a detainee out of the control of the sovereign to another sovereign country.
Right. There's no case.
Are there any cases?
Well, there's no case which, it's the absence of case. There's no case which ever reviews transfer to the authority of another sovereign. And if the writ did extend to that, then Munoz would be wrong. Okay? There's no way around it. They said that you could transfer them to the transfer would have been barred in Munoz because they were arguing they were being unlawfully detained by the United States, and yet we were basically eliminating that habeas case by transferring them.
All right, but I think you're acknowledging that if the Crown transfers custody from the sheriff of one county to the sheriff of another, that's not going to evade the writ.
Right.
So you say, but if the Crown transfers the prisoner to France, then it will evade the writ.
The writ would not extend to that. There's no, as Munoz says, the habeas authority does not.
Deals with prosecution in the other sovereign.
They could have been, whether or not they're prosecuted by Iraq is entirely up to Iraq.
I understand that, but if the prisoner is deported from the United Kingdom to France,
right?
Well, it wasn't United then. From England to France. Not for detention, not for prosecution, but just dropped on the beach and told, "Don't come back." They've circumvented the writ in the same manner.
Well, where you're dealing with, especially an alien, the right, certainly, if you're a Frenchman and you're basically sending him back to France, right? The writ didn't extend to bar him. If you're dealing with a U.S. English citizen and doing it, I think that raises different questions. But
and here we have both some cases involving aliens being returned to their home country, at least that we could have, and aliens being returned to third or sent to third countries.
These right. Restrictions bar us from removing them anywhere from Guantanamo. So, they basically are trying to have it both ways. They vigorously are challenging their detention, and then they're tying our hands in removing to other countries, where the end game they're seeking is to be brought to the United States, let's be clear. So, I mean, they're basically trying to game the system here, challenge the detention, tie our hands, moving them to other countries, and basically, you know, forcing the hand of the courts to bring them to the United States and challenge before the Supreme Court on that. That's entirely unnecessary when a court under Munaf has no authority to bar us from transferring them to other countries.
And when you say in the brief, no law restricting the release of a detainee out of the control into another sovereign, and what do you say to Judge Griffith's point about within or without the jurisdiction and reference to the detainees in their brief make reference to Magna Carta provision dealing with exile? I mean, maybe there are no cases because that was clearly understood as impermissible.
I think, you know, exiling a citizen would have been different. We're sending an alien back to his country or to another country. There's no authority that's part of the Great Writ in 1679 or otherwise. And I think Kasim and Rule 23, as read by Kasim, you know, supports that same distinction. It says, look, Rule 23 bars the United States or state courts, state governments, from transferring a detainee from one hand to another to avoid court review. But in Kasim, when we transfer them out of the country there to Albania, they said that didn't violate Rule 23. That didn't bar the habeas jurisdiction and ordered the cases dismissed. I think that same rationale, which we're saying existed in 1679, as to the rights of aliens not to be sent to other countries, exists here, that there is no habeas right to avoid an alien being sent a transfer to another country. That's the message, even as to citizens, we have as to Munaf. Certainly, if we can, if the habeas right does not protect the citizen's right to be sent to Iraq's custody, all the more so the aliens here have no core habeas right not to be sent back to their own country or to another country. I'm not saying that there's no intention here of sending, you know, the Uyghurs back to their home country, and that's something they, I think, you know, raise here as a sort of a straw man. But the United States should be free to explore all other countries who would be willing to accept them.
Yeah. Further questions? Thank you, Mr. Loeb. We'll give you some time for rebuttal.
Good morning. May it please the court. Christopher Moore of Cleary, Gottlieb, Steen, and Hamilton on behalf of the appellees. The notice orders simply provide the district courts with the opportunity to address the merits of the petitioner's claims before they are unilaterally removed from the court's jurisdiction. Those orders are appropriate under the All Writs Act, Rule 65, and the district court's inherent authority to protect its own jurisdiction.
How could we use the All Writs Act after what Chief Justice Roberts said in Munaf?
There are two prongs to Munaf, and the first is whether or not there was jurisdiction. The second is a ruling as to the merits. As to the first, the Supreme Court confirmed that there was habeas jurisdiction. That's the critical prong as to the application of the All Writs Act. Once there is jurisdiction established, the All Writs Act permits the district court to issue an injunction.
So if we were to find jurisdiction on some other grounds besides the All Writs Act, you'd say go to Rule 65?
That would be the process. You protect the jurisdiction under the All Writs Act, and then as soon as there are sufficient facts before the court to make a ruling on the merits, it would do so. And that's what happened in Munaf. The court confirmed there was jurisdiction and then went to the next step and said, but based on the exceptional facts before the court here, the relief requested is not available.
And what do you say is the first question that's asked under Rule 65 analysis if we went that route? Likelihood of success on the merits, success of what?
Well, success on the merits of the claims, obviously, but there are two types of claims that I think are at issue here. The first claim is the claim for release from unlawful detention, and the second are claims against unlawful transfer. There was a lot of discussion earlier today about the 1679 Habeas Act. It's clear that the purpose of that act was, at the very least, to protect the court's jurisdiction to entertain and address the merits of a claim for release from unlawful detention before the prisoner was removed from the court's jurisdiction. In the respondent's brief, they cite to Article 11 of the 1679 Act. We cite to Article 12, which we believe is the appropriate article to be looking at for purposes of determining whether the district court can prevent or at least obtain notice prior to a transfer, which is really all that's an issue here. Article 11 simply of the 1679 Act provides where the writ runs. Article 12 says that if you are in a place where the writ runs, which Guantanamo is such a place, then you can prevent the transfer of a petitioner while that petitioner has a valid habeas claim pending.
But if the valid habeas claim with respect to the detention was successful, then you'd be entitled to release.
Right? Correct. Release to a safe country.
Right. And with respect to that, what is the source of the of law that precludes the government from sending your clients to a particular country?
Well, I would start with the common law writ. And the reason I would start with that is if a petitioner is entitled to release, that release must mean something. And it must mean release to a safe country, particularly here where the petitioners have, in effect, succeeded on the merits of their claim in light of Parhat.
But how do you then deal with Munaf, which said any right here is satisfied by the government's assurance that it's not more likely than not that the detainee will be tortured upon release and transfer to Iraq?
That's a ruling on the merits, and we can't get to the merits without notice, and that's why we need these notices.
Well, you don't get notice if you have no right to relief on the merits.
We do have
a... It would be illogical to say there's notice if there's no right at the end of the day. So part of what I'm trying to examine is whether there's a right at the end of the day. And on that, Munaf seems to suggest that any due process right in this area, and this was an American citizen in Munaf, is satisfied by the government's assurance in the particular case that it's not more likely than not that the detainee will be tortured upon transfer. Why doesn't that work here?
It doesn't work here. For example, the carve-out that is identified in Munaf is an example of a case where the government has determined that a petitioner would be tortured upon transfer, but decides to send them anyway.
Right, but the government's policy here, as stated and potentially as stated in each individual case, would be consistent with what the government's representation in Munaf was. So the carve-out wouldn't come into play here any more than it came into play in Munaf.
Simply stating what the government's policy is and promising that it will follow that policy does not strip the court of jurisdiction.
That was good enough in Munaf, and that was an American citizen who claimed that he would be tortured upon transfer to a foreign country.
Based on those specific facts, and if there was a...
The specific fact was simply the representation of the government.
It was the representation. It was not...
That was it. It was the representation of the executive branch. In response to the torture claim, the Supreme Court unanimously relied entirely on the representation of the executive branch and did not look any further than the representation of the executive branch that it was not more likely than not that the detainee would be tortured.
With due respect, Munaf, one of the factors that was critical in that case was that the petitioner was being detained by a multinational force at the behest of Iraq. An order for release would have been in effect, and these are the words of the Supreme Court, an order of release issued to Iraq. There was a serious concern there that, not a concern, a finding, that the detention was lawful there. The detention here is unlawful. And the reason I'm making that division is because there are two types of claims. There is a claim for release. We are entitled to that. See Parhat. They didn't have that in Munaf. And there are claims against transfer. With respect to the first, we are entitled to relief in the form of release to a safe country. They did not reach that conclusion.
Well,
I
think Munaf agrees that you're entitled to release to a safe country, but in terms of examining whether that's occurring, Munaf relied solely and exclusively on the representation of the executive branch.
We are entitled, at the very minimum, to notice to determine, so that the court can determine, as it did in Munaf, whether or not the representations are sufficient. There is a carve out there in Munaf.
And I will
concede that may
the
be an exceptional circumstance.
The carve-out only kicks in, at least in the majority opinion, when the executive branch itself says, well, it is more likely than not that the detainee will be tortured, but we're going to transfer him anyway. In that case, that's what the carve-out's for. And the government's representations in this case are not within the carve-out, but are within the square holding of Munaf.
Let's be clear. If we were to receive notice and it was notice of a transfer to a country that would be safe, there would be no further litigation. This that is demonstrated beyond dispute by the three petitioners who were originally in this appeal who all received advance notice.
What if there's a disagreement between the executive branch and you on what's a safe country.
Let me give an example of how that might come up and why it would be important for a district court to analyze that. It is undisputed that these petitioners would be at great risk if they were sent to China or to some other country that would return them to China. The government concedes that. If there were a transfer that were proposed and we had a well-founded fear that that transfer would result in the petitioners ending up in China, whether directly or indirectly, we believe that would be exactly the type of carve-out that was identified in Munaf. That's the type of thing, at a minimum, we need notice for.
Right, so your situation is the government says we're transferring you to country X, which is safe. You're saying country X is not safe, and we need to be able to tell the court that.
That's
correct. So that the court can decide whether it's safe.
That's what the notice is about. So
okay,
that the
listen to this. Tell me how you deal with this. This is Munaf. Even with respect to claims that detainees would be denied constitutional rights if transferred, we have recognized that it is for the political branches, not the judiciary, to assess practices in foreign countries and to determine national policy in light of those assessments. That pretty much reads us out of the picture, doesn't it?
I don't believe it does, Your Honor, because if it did, it would read the court out of the picture with respect to every CAT determination in every extradition context.
Well, the statute may have read us out of the CAT.
Well, the point is there are, and we can address CAT, I'm happy to, but the point is that that language in and of itself does not have the broad sweeping effect of denying courts generally the opportunity or the ability to review any circumstance, a representation.
If that's what you mean. It doesn't go to jurisdiction. It says that you have no cause of action. You could put it in Rule 65 terms, that you have no prospect of success on the merits. And in Munaf, that was exactly the posture in which they said there's no need to remand this for a Rule 65 balancing because you fail as a matter of law based on this rationale.
But Munaf is factually different in exceptional ways.
Well, wait a second. Is it different in ways that relate to the role of the political branches, well, particularly the executive, in dealing with other countries? How is it different in that respect?
I want to be very clear here. If we received notice and there was a representation by the government and we agreed with that, that the transfer
it's
would
only
be...
only when you disagree. Forget the when you agree case.
Right. But we
you
don't...
You disagree and you ask the court to resolve the difference. And we've got a passage from the Supreme Court saying that's not a judicial function.
At the very least, there must be a representation by the government with respect to an actual proposed transfer. There have been mistakes in this case by the government, and these petitioners have been held for more than 6 years without legal basis. They have been subjected to treatment while they were there.
Where's the accept in cases of mistake provision in what I read to you? Where do you read that in?
My point, Your Honor, is that the government has held people in these cases without legal basis. The government has invited Chinese interrogators to Guantanamo to visit these detainees, notwithstanding
how
the fact
how do you imagine that hearing is going to look if it goes the way you want? Right? The government comes in and says you're proposing to send it to country X, and we know that it's not likely that they'll be tortured there. And then what are you going to do? What's your evidence going to be?
Well, let's take the example if they were to be transferred to China.
Well, that's off the table. No one's talking about China.
Well,
the government's
with due
not
respect,
propose
I don't
China.
Understand why it's off the table, because that's a serious concern of ours, that they would either end up at China directly or indirectly, or that is a concern of ours.
Well, but the government's already conceded that they're not going to be making the case that it's not likely they'll be tortured there. So in that case, you've won. But what about some other place?
If there was some other place and we had a similar concern and it was well-founded and well-documented, that they would be tortured or that it's likely they would be tortured.
I'm trying to, what's the evidence? You can have affidavits? You can have witnesses come in?
We would have the opportunity to present whatever evidence we have.
And then you'd have the government would present their evidence, and then you'd have the court deciding who's more credible here, the executive branch, whether they're more credible about the justice system of another country or you are. That's exactly the inquiry that we're told. The judiciary is not suited to second guess such determinations. I mean, that's a pretty strong language we have no role there.
I understand that, Your Honor, but that statement was made in the context of a case that related to a person who voluntarily transferred to Iraq, who was being prosecuted under Iraqi law, was being held by forces that were integral to the Iraqi criminal judicial system. That case turned on deference to Iraqi sovereignty.
In the hearing that Judge Griffith was discussing, would the government be forced to disclose the content of its discussions with other countries?
These are the type of questions that should be addressed by the district court on a case-by-case basis. If we were told they were being sent to China...
Well, the district court's going to have to answer that. The district court will ask you that same question, so...
I understand
pretend
that.
Pretend we're in the district court. Okay. What do you say when you get that question?
I understand your point, Your Honor, and my point is that it really would depend on the transfer, and it really would depend on what evidence we had, whether we needed more information, whether we didn't need more information. If, for example, the proposed transfer were to China or to another country that would in turn send them to China,
so it's
we
possible,
don't need much more.
It's at
we
least
need
possible that.
That
the executive branch would be forced to discuss the contents of its discussions with other countries. And the executive branch represents, and Munaf seems to support, the idea that that could chill the other countries from engaging in these discussions in the first place, because they may not want those discussions revealed in open court and then causing international controversy.
I don't know whether that would be required by the district court or not. And I want to address, if I could, the allegation.
Even if the district court doesn't require disclosure and publicity and so on of those negotiations, the government says we're not even going to get to that point in some cases because we're going to be dealing with another government and saying, you know, whatever we agree to, by the way, is subject to approval of the court. Like, is this for this were a treaty that had to go to the Senate? And that's enough to queer the matter as far as some countries are concerned. If you don't have settlement authority, as it were, then get me someone who does.
Let's take, for example, the assertion earlier this morning that the transfer of the five Uyghurs to Albania in 2006, that the success of that was, quote, critical upon the absence of the notice requirement. There is no evidence of that in the record. In fact, the record supports the opposite conclusion. Two more petitioners were sent to Albania who did have notice requirements, who were in these appeals merely months later to the same country. Why is it that a group of petitioners who didn't have a notice requirement were sent in, it was June or July of 2006, and in November 2006, two more petitioners, Zakirjan and Aladdin, the other two captions that no longer exist in these appeals, received notice, consented to the transfer. The transfer happened in less than 30 days to the exact same country. I don't see how...
The government says in its brief, and there's no citation, but it says, the absence of court notice requirements was critical to the U.S. ability to negotiate quietly and successfully the transfer of a group of Uyghurs in 2006. Now, suppose that the government could now, on request, produce documentary evidence to that effect. Is that the end of the case for you?
That's not the end of the case. My point is that that is a statement that's simply argument. It has no reference to it, and the record supports the opposite conclusion. There were petitioners sent to the same country that do have notice.
That doesn't get us anywhere. The question is, the only relevant group are those who have not been sent anywhere, as to whom it may be precisely because, and who are subject to a transfer order. It may be, as the government implies, precisely because of the transfer order that it's difficult and thus far impossible to place them.
With due respect, there's no evidence of that. And in fact, if we want to talk about why there are certain Uyghurs who are left in Guantanamo and why the five were sent, the five who were sent had all been designated as non-enemy combatants. As non-enemy combatants. The nine who remain were wrongfully designated as enemy combatants, which this court confirmed in Parhat.
Okay, so they've been, not wrongfully, but inadequately, right?
It was an improper designation.
So there can be another CSIRT with respect to
which they have represented they will not do. Mm-hmm. So that's not an option. That's off the table. So they are left with either transferring or releasing these petitioners. The reason the first five were sent was because all agreed that they were properly designated as non-enemy combatants. The others were designated as enemy combatants. This court has now confirmed that they are non-enemy combatants.
That's not quite right.
I'm sorry. This court held that they had not properly been determined as enemy combatants.
If a group of Chinese citizens arrived at the border of the United States and were detained by immigration authorities, longstanding Supreme Court precedent says that in excluding them from the country, those applicants would have no due process rights. So why would detainees at Guantanamo have greater rights than people who arrived at a port of entry into the United States?
Well, first, I have two answers to that. First, Boumediene spent a great deal of time discussing, for example, minimum procedural protections to which Guantanamo detainees were entitled. That in and of itself suggests that Fifth Amendment procedural due process rights run to Guantanamo. And as you mentioned earlier, due process rights are intertwined with habeas rights. Habeas rights clearly run, or the writ clearly runs, to Guantanamo, so too do
due process. But it would be somewhat anomalous to say that people at Guantanamo have greater rights than people at the border who arrive at an airport or a port of entry into the United States.
Well, I don't think...
Greater constitutional rights. Now, those people have statutory rights, and that's a different issue.
Right. And I wanted to talk briefly about that, and that is Munaf did make one point that's clear, and that is there's a case, Valentine, that was discussed in Munaf. And with respect to a person who is in the United States needs to demonstrate a legal basis for sending them to another country.
Yeah, that's a little different than the person who's detained at the border, which was my hypothetical.
I'm sorry, at the border. They have not. I'm sorry. I thought you said they were inside the United States. And so you're, I'm sorry, what was your question?
Well, the people at the border, the Supreme Court has said in a series of 1950s cases, which they've reaffirmed, people detained at the border have no rights under the Due Process Clause with respect to their exclusion from the United States. And so I'm just pointing out it may be some, maybe those cases are no longer good law, although they've been referenced in Zedvitas and other cases.
I don't think we need to go there either way. And the reason is because we're talking about
petitioners. Aren't you relying on the Due Process Clause as one of the two primary sources of the rights with respect to the transfer?
We are relying on the Due Process Clause. What I meant by not needing to go there was to address the rights of a person who is not within the U.S. jurisdiction, which I believe is what your hypothetical was. And the reason I'm saying we don't need to go to that analogy is because we are talking about petitioners who were brought against their will into the United States.
Guantanamo is more like someone who's already in the United States.
Correct, which is what was held by the Supreme Court in Rasool and Boumediene, which is why I don't think the analogy applies. I, as I stand here, I don't know what the rights of a person who is at the border but not in the United States are, but that's irrelevant to our case. That's our position. I also wanted...
Excuse me, are there further questions? No. What other subject did you want to touch on?
If the court has no further questions, then...
Okay. Thank you very much, Mr. Moore. Mr. Loeb, if you want up to 2 minutes to reply but not to repeat, you're welcome.
I really don't have any further points unless the court has some questions. I would just make a quick note that his point about the people moved to Albania, the other two were not Uyghurs and don't raise the same diplomatic sensitivities as the Uyghurs who were moved. And the ones who remain here are Uyghurs, and the fact that they still remain and the others are in Albania, I think, speaks volumes by itself. I would note that the people in exclusion proceedings are, in fact, in the United States. That's where they're being detained, so the irony is pretty thick on that.
The question of the proper analogy for Guantanamo as to immigration is not easy. But
right. Our view is Eisenträger remains good law as to the Due Process Clause. It hasn't been expressly overruled, and that as a lower court under Agostani, you're still bound by that. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. Loeb. Mr. Moore, thank you. Case is submitted.